As I was telling a few others, I work in the Washington, D.C. area, live between Baltimore and Washington, and I had to escape to Canada to get away from the snow. Something is wrong with this picture. Well, they're in the middle of a huge, officially determined a blizzard right this minute that I'm missing. And I was told by my husband this morning that I may not be able to get back for days. Anyway, so thank you for your warm welcome here in Canada. I am not going to give you a talk on theoretical physics, so I hope that's okay. I want to tell you instead about what we have been doing with the Hubble Space Telescope over the last year. It's been a very exciting year for our Hubble Space Telescope program. One of the major missions that we run at Goddard Space Flight Center is, in fact, Hubble. NASA, the space agency in the U.S., has 10 centers. And they sort of concentrate on different things. So you know about Kennedy Space Center in Florida and Johnson Space Center in Texas handling the astronauts. But Goddard Space Flight Center focuses more on science missions, including the Hubble Space Telescope, other space telescopes, and Earth-observing satellites that are looking at things like climate change and water, oceans, and agriculture, things like that. So I want to tell you a little bit about what's going on with Hubble and what's happened over the last year and the kind of interesting science that we're hoping to do with the telescope. Just a little overview of how telescopes have improved over the years. So this is an observational science. And we just celebrated the 400th anniversary of Galileo first pointing his telescope to the sky. There's a lot of controversy over, was that really the first telescope? And I think the answer is no. Was that really the first time somebody actually looked at something in the sky with a telescope? And I think now the answer to that is no. But now they're saying that Galileo was the first one to observe something in the heavens and write it down, make scientific notes of it so that it could be, you could try to reproduce the results or things like that. So anyway, something important happened about 400 years ago. And since then, optics have improved throughout history. Notice that this is a logarithmic scale on the left, so these improvements are enormous. Oh, I forgot to use the pointer. I'm not used to this. We don't do this in the U.S. So eyepieces have gotten better. Telescopes went from 20 inches, 48 inches was huge, 72 inches. And then in the 20th century, we start getting the large observatories, Mount Wilson at 100-inch, Mount Palomar with a 200-inch mirror. These are very large facilities, and their capabilities have enabled just many more fantastic discoveries, including most notably the discovery of galaxies themselves. And then we started launching things into space. And the Hubble Space Telescope improvement here is orders of magnitude better than anything that we've had before. So this is why we get a lot of good data out of the Hubble Space Telescope. It's a very, very profound improvement over anything we've had before. And Hubble was designed to become a new observatory every few years. Yes?
I'm just curious if you could tell me, sort of say something precise about what you're measuring on the vertical axis here. What do you mean
Okay.
by sensitivity over the eye?
I mean, how much better? This is not my chart, so I don't know exactly what they're talking about, but I think it's exactly what it says. How much? To look at to observe the same faint object, how much more time would you need to stare at it in order to see it over what you would need with your naked eye if you could record? And it's a little hard to say because you don't have like a CCD in your eye, but what is the time frame to get to the depth of faintness compared to the human eye if you could record what you were seeing with the human eyes.
I guess my main
Yeah.
question is just counting resolution and magnification and sharpness as well, or purely photo detection threshold?
I think purely photodetection threshold. Let's not dwell on this. This is sort of a conceptual, I can look this up for you later, but this is more just a kind of intro. Golly gee, this is really cool chart, and then we can wrestle with these details a little bit later. So, but the point that I'm actually trying to get to is this little dark part here is that this last year we did another servicing mission, which is where you you know, the telescope was designed to be serviced by astronauts every few years, where you get new instruments, new cameras, new capabilities. And so you basically get a new observatory every few years. And this past year, we were able to do one more servicing mission with the space shuttle. And look, it's off the charts. So isn't that amazing? So that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today. SM4, the servicing mission 4, is what we did in this past year. And it is, quite obviously, the fifth servicing mission of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is why NASA calls it SM4. There were two SM3s, so anyway, just to remind you why Hubble is fabulous, and Hubble was able to start for the first time differentiating individual stars and in galactic star clusters to a greater degree than had been capable of being done from the ground before. I love the star cluster because it shows basically pictorially you can see the variety of stars within one cluster, fluxes and colors and so forth. We've been able to look into star-forming regions like never before, evolve stars. This is the Crab Nebula, to watch the whole stellar evolution process like never before, and to see galaxy evolution like never before. So these, what I love about Hubble is, okay, so this is one of these gorgeous Hubble images, NGC 1309, beautiful name. And the background junk, you know, in the picture, the static that gets in here is also just these gorgeous background galaxies. I don't know if you can see it on the screen, but it really is quite awe-inspiring just to look at the picture. One of the main purposes of Hubble was, when it was launched, was to discern the Hubble constant, to really try to quantify the expansion rate of the universe and hone it down. And it has certainly contributed to that effort to the point where everyone is in agreement now that it's in about the 72, 73 range. So this is a great accomplishment of Hubble. This is the ultra-deep field that I'm sure that most of you recognize, showing just a pencil beam, but showing the absolute staggering numbers of galaxies at redshifts that had not been seen before. And many, many scientific studies are now being done to actually, you know, discern which of these are truly the most highly redshifted galaxies that we see. And again, I'm just showing you a little preamble of what's been done, and I'll get more into depth on this later in the talk. All right. We're going to spend about 15 minutes here having a little fun, and then I'll go back to the science. The mission that we did in this past May was very difficult to get on the books. I was the oversight scientist at NASA headquarters from 2003 to 2006, and one of the first things that happened when I got there, a few months after I started work, was that this servicing mission that had been planned, the administrator of NASA canceled it and said we would never service Hubble again. This did not go over well with the science community, and it did not go over well with the public, and so it was a very, very difficult time. The reason it was canceled was that we had recently had a space shuttle accident. I don't know if you remember this Columbia accident when the shuttle had launched. They had done a week or two science mission, and then as they were landing, apparently there had been a breach in the wing of the shuttle on launch, and they didn't know it during the mission. And then upon landing, heat was able to encroach in that little breach on the wing where a piece of foam had rammed into the wing, and it basically allowed heat to enter the system. It created a huge instability and the thing exploded. It was very tragic. So at that point, the NASA leaders realized that shuttles could be damaged upon launch, and if you were in some orbit where you could not in fact repair the shuttle, you would be doomed basically. And so it was decided that from then on, every shuttle mission would only go to the International Space Station. So we've got the space station going, and if you go to the space station, you can hang out there for a week or two and get all the help you need. You could hang out for months if you needed to. So it's a safer place to go. The space, Hubble is in a different orbit, and it's impossible dynamically, apparently, to get the shuttle from one orbit to the other. Now, this also did not go over well because people were saying, well, hey, astronauts take risks. That's what they do. That's their job description, you know. So they should still go and do this mission, and the astronauts wanted to do it. And so There were years of discussions about, you know, should we try this mission or not? Maybe we should try it with a robot. We spent a whole year developing a robotic mission that used no astronauts to go in and go up, attach on to Hubble, and do some of the basic instrument exchanges. Believe it or not, this was actually working. We had this robot at NASA Goddard, where I worked, in the clean room, and the robot had this robotic arm that would pull out the old instruments in this model of Hubble and put in the new one, and did it quite well. So the astronauts might feel very threatened by this, I don't know. But still, it was, you know, to really do all the complicated things that we wanted to do, we wanted astronauts to go back. In the meantime, more instruments were starting to break down on Hubble. So the instruments that were already on Hubble, the Advanced Camera for Surveys and the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph, ACS and STIS, both of them began to malfunction during this period of time. They were very difficult to repair, and we had to come up with concepts for how to repair them on orbit and try to sell that to the NASA leadership. These are electronics boxes that were not designed to be fixed in space. They had, STIS, for example, had 111 little tiny screws on the front plate of this instrument. So imagine being an astronaut with, you know, with these big bulky gloves, you know, pressurized, trying to remove these tiny little screws. And of course, you don't want them flying around into the telescope bus as well. So, you know, trying to come up with a clever way of doing this was challenging, and the engineers at Goddard did this. They figured out how to put a cover plate over these instruments that had nice little holes you could fit a little screwdriver through, but they weren't big enough for the screws to actually come back out, so you kind of held them in this cover plate. So anyway, they came up with some ingenious ideas, and we decided we would do the mission if we could have a second shuttle ready to go in case something went wrong with the first launch. The second shuttle could go up and nominally, I don't know what exactly would have happened. The idea was that you would create some sort of life bridge between the two shuttles and have all the astronauts from one sort of, you know, go rope to rope, hand to hand from one to the other. And can you imagine watching that on television? But anyway, it was somehow deemed that made the mission slightly more safe. And so finally, after 3 years of this hand-wringing, we got the go-ahead to actually do one more astronaut servicing mission to Hubble, including the original things that we wanted to put in, which is a brand new camera. I'm sorry for the acronyms, but this is the Wide Field Camera 3, which is a panchromatic camera that sees from the ultraviolet through the visible wavelength ranges and into the near-infrared, and the Cosmic Origins Spectrograph, which is an ultraviolet spectrograph that's extremely sensitive, more sensitive than any UV spectrograph we've had before. And then to go ahead and repair the Advanced Camera for Surveys and the STIS spectrograph, which have different capabilities than the Wide Field Camera 3 and the CLS. And there, of course, were other things that need to be done as well. We needed to put in new gyroscopes to help the telescope point, new batteries, a new fine guidance sensor, new insulation, a new soft capture mechanism, which is basically a little metal ring on the back of the telescope that allows eventually for us to send something up to latch onto it and guide it gently and safely into the ocean. So one day when Hubble is finished, we really don't want the last thing it to do is to fall on Waterloo or anywhere else. So we need to be able to guide it carefully where we need it to go. And so these were the things that we wanted to do on the mission. We finally got the go-ahead to do it, and the astronauts trained, and by that point, you know, many of the electronics had to be updated a little bit. But the goal was that when the astronauts would leave Hubble for this last time, it would be left at the apex of its capabilities, better than it had ever been before. So it would have these combinations of instruments that would work together. NICMOS is a camera that was already on there and still is. It's an infrared camera. So we have three cameras and two spectrographs, and we would have a wide suite of capabilities, and I'll get into some of these details a little bit later. It is an observatory. It's not a telescope. It's an observatory which has these multiple instruments, multiple capabilities, so you can do all kinds of astrophysics, including imaging, spectroscopy, astrometry, measuring motions and positions of stars, and everything from cosmology to galaxy evolution, star formation, and even exoplanet type work. All right, so there's our crew, our happy crew that finally gets to go out and do this mission. And one of the reasons that it's the last mission is that it looks like the space shuttle itself only has a few more launches before NASA actually is closing down the entire space shuttle program. It's sort of a sad end of an era going on right now. So I don't know if you've been listening to all the news on NASA, but it's a very confusing time for NASA right now. We had planned to return to the moon, but there wasn't enough money to do that program, so that's been kind of put on hold, and the space shuttle program is ending, but we won't have another launch mechanism for many years. So, but the space station will keep going, so we have to figure out how to keep getting up and down from there. So it's a confusing time. Anyway, there's our crew. This was May 11th of this past year.
We're approaching the end of the shuttle here. So this will be the last time we'll watch a shuttle launch for a whole mission,
and
that's both exciting and it makes you wistful, a little nostalgic.
Hubble has arguably been the most spectacular scientific instrument in history, in my opinion. This is the mission that is going to make Hubble actually with the best complement of instruments it has ever had, and prolong its life by installing new batteries, new gyroscopes, and so on.
Hubble right now, before this mission, was sort of hobbling along. It's been 7 years since we serviced it, and it's, if you take your 5,000-mile service interval for a car and you say, I'm going to wait until 10,000 miles, things start to break. And we've had that problem, particularly with our scientific instruments. So we're not only going to restore or replenish the toolkit of scientific instruments that we have, but the ones that we're putting in are better than any we've ever had before.
T-minus 10, 9,
I got to be out there
8,
the media,
7,
right? And I got to be
6,
out here
the 4,
science.
3, 2, 1, and
liftoff of Space Shuttle Atlantis. Final visit to enhance the vision of Hubble, the grandeur of our universe.
Crab seems pretty nice. Oh, my crab.
So Hubble.
Watch out. These are acid headquarters.
Up to this point, it's just preparation, just prologue for what's going to come after this mission is over.
That's me.
With the new tools we have and the incredible new technology we're going to apply to our science, I think the prior years of Hubble kind of opened doors, and now we're going to go through them.
Now, what we didn't know was they're
Atlantis
not doing
is,
that.
Continuing in its due easterly course to catch up with the Hubble Space Telescope one last time.
The first 30 seconds or so, there were all kinds of alarms going on in the shuttle cockpit there, and the ground mission control was having to decide just real time whether to abort the mission. And by aborting the mission, that means trying to return back to Kennedy Space Center, and that was never really been done before. So it was a very difficult time to decide whether or not these sensors that were, the alarms going off, whether they were actually indicating engine failure or whether there was a sensor problem. And they decided in the end that it was a sensor problem. But I always tell people when I hear that, when I see that launch and think about seven people being on the top of that thing, and then to know not only the launch, that would scare me to death anyway, but that they were hearing these, you know, death alarms going off. Now I know why astronauts wear diapers. It's really, really important. Okay, so I'm going to spend just about 5 or 10 minutes more here on the fun part of the mission, and then we'll talk about the new science we're getting. So here's what it looks like. The shuttle goes up to the orbit where Hubble is and takes this grapple arm. And by the way, Canadians have been really taking the lead in development of robotic arms here for the space program. So they pulled the telescope into the payload bay of the shuttle. This is what it looks like from inside as you're looking out. And we have our astronauts taking their different roles. John Brunsfeld here is an astronomer in his own right, and he's recently taken the role as the deputy director of the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore that oversees the science mission of the observatory. Here's one of the astronauts, and you can look in the faceplate there and see another one. they have these wonderful little lights and cameras on their helmets. So we could actually, from down in the mission control room where I was working, you could see exactly what the astronaut was seeing while they were out in the bay. And of course, half the time it's dark out there because the orbit is a 90-minute orbit. It's low Earth orbit. So the shuttle and the telescope and the payload bay are going around once every 90 minutes. And so it's dark. You need those lights to see what's going on. So there were some issues. The first day was to put in this brand new camera. Really, the showcase piece of this whole servicing mission is the Wide Field Camera 3. And we had problems right off the bat. To get the Wide Field Camera 3 in, you had to kick the Wide Field Camera 2 out. And to get the Wide Field Camera 2 out, you had to undo a bolt. Okay, pretty straightforward. You take it, unscrew a bolt, take it out. And the bolt wouldn't come out. It was a real problem. So here is what it looked like from the astronaut's point of view. They didn't want to try it too much torque, because if you break the top off the bolt, then you're really sunk. There's really nothing you can do. So how much torque do you put on this thing until you can loosen it without breaking it? And they kept trying. They kept going over and over the maximum amount of torque they thought they should use, and kept trying it. And finally, they got it out. I thought there was a little film with that, but I guess there's not.
Oh, yeah. Woohoo, it's moving out. Four. Great job. Great news.
So, there's a great release.
It was tougher to do than we thought, but, you know, it has ended with just beautifully. Well, I've just lost 5 years of my life.
Yeah, we were really, really, really extremely stressed out when they couldn't get that bolt, and it was like all the years of work getting ready for this were just crumbling before our eyes, and that was a great relief. So then they were able to take it out of that slot and put the new camera in. They're like pieces of pie. You take the old slot out and you put the new slice in. And then we put in the Cosmic Origin spectrograph, and that's like a big box, and it went in smoothly. That was a good day. I don't think there's any film there, yeah. And then we did this, started these complicated repairs where we had to remove these bolts and the advanced camera for surveys repair. Let's see if that one went pretty well. Okay, so they're taking out these electronics plates. They're putting in replacement plates for these broken electronics. And let's just move on. The STIS repair had a similar issue. I worked on this one for years at headquarters after it broke down to see if we could win the ability to do this repair. It is probably the most complicated repair. This is the one with 111 screws. And the problem with this is that to get into this compartment in the telescope, there was a metal bar that had to be removed. Well, that was no big deal. The astronauts, that was one of the most trivial things they had to do. There were four bolts to take this thing off. Well, again, we had a problem with the fourth bolt, and they tried again to try to get the right amount of torque on this thing. Nothing worked. They get more powerful screwdrivers. He tried for hours. They were, you know, running out of time, and I was becoming extremely crestfallen that all these years of work and practice were being lost. But I'm very, very thankful that they were able finally to get the handrail out of the way, and I'll show you how finally, after trying all the screwdrivers and things.
That darn handrail. Sunset in 11 minutes.
Very worried, couldn't get the handrail off.
Houston, you ready for this?
This is how you do it.
Yeah, we're ready.
Okay, Mass, you have a go.
Here we go.
If you can't unscrew it, just tear it off.
Disposal bag, please. Okay.
It's brute force, and it worked. Yes. Well, you know, it's thermal, you know, thermal changes. I mean, you try to, you know, predict all these things ahead of time, but those things, some of them have been up there over more than 10 years or more. So, you know, this thermal cycling every time it orbits the Earth, and just over time, these thermal changes can change the grip on these things. So, you know, you live and learn. Okay. So they were able to do the STIS repair and finally lift Hubble out of the payload bay and release it, and it was a very dramatic and happy moment when that happened. So there it is, a picture of it that the astronauts took from inside the shuttle, looking out through the window and saying goodbye to Hubble for the last time, setting it on its way. This is the grapple fixture for the future mission that may come and give Hubble a ride home. And the astronauts got a safe ride home, and we were very, very grateful to them for what they did. I'm truly impressed by how hard it was what they did up there. So, and there were hundreds of people on the ground supporting this mission, including me. I got to work in the mission control room at Johnson. I said, I'd do anything if I could just work in there. Can I have a job? So they let me be on one of the communications panels and be a science spokesperson. So that was really exciting. All right, so that was the mission itself. And I hope you enjoyed that little fun trip. And now I want to show you just some samples of some of the early release images and science that's coming out of the telescope that I think is going to is starting to play a major role in astrophysics already. It took the whole summer to calibrate the new instruments and the repaired instruments and to get them ready to go. And then sort of the new, what we call early release observations were released so that people could see, especially the public, could see what kinds of products they had paid for and what kind of images you could expect to see. The very first thing we saw was totally unexpected. In fact, we had to put the camera online earlier than it had actually been planned to capture this. If you remember in 1994, do you remember when the comet fell apart and rammed into Jupiter? And this was a very unusual event. It was torn apart tidally and hit in the Jupiter atmosphere in several places. Sobering moment, but it was supposed to be, you know, once every few hundred years that something like this would happen. Well, it happened again in 2009. And again, an object was spotted falling into the atmosphere of Jupiter. And so immediately the Hubble camera was turned on quickly and pointed so it could image this impact of this object, presumably a comet, onto Jupiter, into the atmosphere of Jupiter. And keep in mind that this is the size of Earth, all right? So, you know, the fact that we have a relatively high frequency of impacting objects in the solar system that are create damage areas quite large compared to the Earth is something to keep in mind. Of course, this is gas. This is an atmospheric disturbance, but nevertheless, we are in a very active solar system as well. All right, this was a calibration image, and I just, you know, it's one of the things that you just kind of, open my mouth and say, wow, and I see this. It really shows you the color contrast of the new camera, and it is quite spectacular. So this camera actually goes off into the near infrared and the ultraviolet as well, but you can really see the dynamics of stars just visually here through this first early release image of the wide field camera 3. All right. Here's another early release image showing you a star-forming region in our galaxy. These are ground-based images to start out with, but as we zoom in to the Carina Nebula, and we're going to look at something buried deep inside it with the Hubble Space Telescope, you're going to see one of these pillars of star formation. When stars form, the new stars tend to blow away the less dense gas, leaving these dense columns. But peering inside the columns has always been problematic until now, because with the Wide Field Camera 3 infrared channel, we can actually peer into these dusty columns and see what's going on. Now, I don't know if you saw what happened there so quickly. I wonder if I have another. Yeah. So this column of dense gas, which we see often in star-forming regions in the galaxy, are left over dense regions where the gas remains while the less dense gas is kind of pushed away more easily by the stellar winds of recently formed stars. Well, it is in these denser regions where we can get continuing star formation, usually of the next generation of lower mass stars. And you can tell that there's something going on here because you see this kind of evidence of an outflowing jet. And it turns out that any accreting object tends to have an outflowing jet if there are magnetic fields involved. So accreting protostars themselves have magnetic fields and tend to go through a phase of bipolar jets as they're accreting. You can see the evidence of the jets, but you can't see in here because it's optically occluded by the dust in this column. Some people think this looks like E.T. Remember when E.T. was phoning home, Jimmy? But the infrared channel on the wide-field camera 3 comes to the rescue, and we can actually peer in there, see the protostellar object, and see the bipolar jet that actually has a little S shape, which is common for precessing systems. What else can we see? By being able to differentiate stars in dense clusters, we're able to see stars, basically the evolution of star formation in star-forming regions. So this is 30 Doradus, where we can actually see different ages of evolution of young stars as you move from inside to outside the clusters. So here we have the stars that are the most mature. These pre-main sequence stars have already evolved to the main sequence of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram here. Farther into the cloud, you get a mixture of young and old stars. And in the middle, you see the very young pre-main sequence stars only as you chart them on the diagram. So this is just an example of what you can do if you can differentiate stars. And this is in the Large Magellanic Cloud. So we're actually able to do that in other galaxies now, which is a very helpful feature of a sensitive and high-resolution telescope like Hubble. Here's another example of being able to see what looks like two stellar populations instead of one in this very dense star cluster, Omega Centauri. In Omega Centauri, which is a star cluster with absolutely billions of stars, which is more than usual in clusters of stars. And by being able to differentiate individual stars, which the high angular resolution of Hubble allows, you can actually flesh out the color magnitude diagrams as stellar astrophysicists like to do, and discern that in fact there are two populations of stars in here. So the different colors of stars here represent the different kinds of stars and where they end up on this diagram. And the fact that there are, in fact, double branches, like here and here, is indicative that these are probably two populations of stars. It's long been hypothesized that this star cluster may, in fact, be a core of another galaxy that's having merged with our own galaxy and has a mixture of the original galaxy's stars and some of our own galaxy's new population of stars. And the only way you can discern that is being able to differentiate individual stars and plot them on these color magnitude diagrams. That is a feature that we now have with our new camera. Let's go in. Oh, this is a good one. Okay. If we go into this region, Centaurus, we're falling into the middle of this cluster. And then you get to the bright stars that I showed you before. Isn't that cool? All right. Enough. The Butterfly Nebula represents the evolved state of a low-mass star that's losing its outer atmosphere. We call them planetary nebulae, but they have nothing to do with planets. But they do show kind of the dynamics of the stellar ejection of processed material into the interstellar medium. I just like that one because it's pretty. Okay, come on. All right, what about supernova remnants? We also have the idea of supernovae as ejecting processed material into the interstellar medium. So a supernova, as you know, is extremely bright. And a supernova remnant tells you exactly what kind of processed material is being ejected into the interstellar medium. This is one supernova remnant in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And the cosmic origin spectrograph, remember that very detailed spectrograph, I believe, was honing in on some of this supernova debris. You can kind of see it around here in this image in the wide-field camera theory, but let's look at it spectroscopically. Yeah, we're looking in there. All right. When we look at it spectroscopically, we can actually do the component analysis of what kinds of processed material is actually getting ejected into the ISM. And here we see that oxygen and carbon are quite strong. Dirty Doradus, M83. Okay, I'm going to skip some of that. It just shows you that we can differentiate star-forming regions. Okay, let's look outside of our galaxy. I don't have to tell you all what gravitational lensing is, but this is kind of a nice movie anyway. We see a lot of evidence of gravitational lensing. Yeah, come on, movie. Oh, wait, is it working? There we go. Okay, this is a black hole between us and Baltimore. And as we look at the skyline of Baltimore as it goes around the black hole, it is, of course, getting distorted through gravitational lensing. And, of course, that is what we see looking with Hubble through very dense clusters of galaxies toward distant galaxies and quasars. We see distortions in the light. And so I'm going to show you what that looks like. This is the world's slowest movie. There we go. All right. So you're all familiar with this. But light from a distant galaxy coming through a nearby cluster of galaxy will be bent mostly by the dark matter in that cluster, and will end up giving us gravitational lensing and distortions that are quite interesting in and of themselves, but they also help us to map out the dark matter in the foreground cluster. So if you can actually map out the regions where you're seeing the most distortions in the background galaxy, that tells you something about the dark matter distribution in the foreground cluster. Okay. So here is some of these interesting distortions that you see. And in particular, I think this is a very interesting snake-like distorted galaxy. These are the foreground clusters, and then you see the lens material around the foreground lens. So this is one spiral galaxy from the background cluster. It's both magnified and completely distorted and stretched out by the foreground lens. Yes?
What's lens and what's just a different galaxy?
How can you make out what's
an image of a galaxy? Two things which are images of each other, and how do you know it's not a different galaxy altogether?
Rather than two images of the same galaxy. Well, you can sometimes tell by just the symmetry if the foreground material has been kind enough to give you a symmetric lens, you can tell sometimes by that. Sometimes you can't, right? If the foreground material is distributed, you know, in a very asymmetric fashion, you can't really tell if a lensed thing on one side is exactly the same object as a lensed on the other side. You can do more detailed spectroscopic analysis to see if, you know, are they basically at the same redshift? Are they, you know, the same composition? Then that can give you a clue that it's probably the same galaxy. So, yeah. All right, here's some other examples of lensed objects, distorted things. All right. We can also now do with our cosmic origin spectrograph studies of the intergalactic medium, or more importantly, what we refer to as the cosmic web. So we, of course, understand that the beginning of the universe led to this cosmic microwave background radiation, which is now mapped out in great detail in terms of its temperature and density variations, and people are using this now to project forward to understand the impacts of dark energy over the age of the universe. But we also want to understand structure formation as part of this. This is the temperature and density variation of the cosmic microwave background radiation over the whole sky projected onto the plane of the screen as mapped by WMAP, which is the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. How do we study structure formation over time? Well, one thing is to understand how galaxies are interconnected, and it turns out that galaxies are clusters of matter that are represented here by where the earliest temperature variation, the spatial scale of the earliest temperature variations appear. The galaxies now represent these mass over densities, and as the universe evolved, And it turns out these galaxies are connected by what we call the cosmic web of intergalactic medium. But mapping out that intergalactic material has been next to impossible because it's so tenuous and it's so hard to see. Here's a little movie that I hope works that shows you just pictorially how you can simulate and model the development of cosmic structure over time. So if you start with that cosmic microwave background distribution of temperature and density and let the movie run, please don't ask me what parameters they put in this and which universe input, because I didn't do the simulation, but you can see that you end up with structure formation that is very similar to what we now see when you map out the galaxy distribution in terms of the densest regions. But what about all the stuff that connects the galaxies together? That's what we've had trouble seeing before. And with the cosmic origin spectrograph, we can now do it by looking at distant quasars. So we do little pencil beam maps looking at distant quasars such as this one. And having the super sensitivity of the cosmic origin spectrograph, we can actually look through the cosmic web at the distant quasar and actually map the absorption of everything along the line of sight through the cosmic web. And by doing these pencil beams toward every quasar you can possibly find, you can get a pretty good handle on the distribution of this cosmic web of material in all three dimensions of space. So that is the main goal of the cosmic origin spectrograph. It's already starting to work. They've already looked, for example, at this particular quasar and can map out by differentiating these different sets of hydrogen absorption lines along the line of sight where there are intergalactic medium filaments along that line of sight. So the proof of concept has already worked. Earlier attempts at doing this were so noisy that you couldn't really differentiate these different clusters of lines. So this is a tremendous success for COSS, we call it. What about looking as far as you possibly can in terms of galaxies? One of the most exciting results to date on Hubble has been finding the most distant galaxies that are observable today with our current capabilities. So here we have, using that new infrared channel on this wide field camera 3, the ability to find the most redshifted objects that we can see. So we have, these represent three of these filters in the near infrared, and I'm going to show you how that's done. So what you're looking for is the Lyman break. You know, every spectrum of these galaxies has a break where everything short of 912 angstroms is absorbed, and so you can tell the redshift of the galaxy by finding out where exactly the emission appears to disappear. And if you have different filter bands, and you look at that same galaxy in different filter bands, and you find that the galaxy absolutely does not appear in one of the filter bands, that gives you a very good handle on the redshift of that galaxy. So here's an example. This is called photometric redshifts of looking at this in four different filters, U, B, V, and I in this case, and noting that this particular galaxy appears in B, V, and I, but is totally absent in U. And by seeing, you know, by comparing filters in this way, you can tell exactly how redshifted this spectrum must be. This is the photometric redshifting technique that's being used right off the bat with Hubble to determine some of the most redshifted galaxies in these ultra-deep fields. So they've gone back to that ultra-deep field of galaxies that I showed earlier, but this time looked at it with the new Wide Field Camera 3 with its infrared channel, and are now finding galaxies that are more redshifted than we've ever seen before. Keep in mind that we believe the universe is 13.7 billion years old. Well, now we're seeing galaxies that have already formed at that, you know, 0.7 time frame from the beginning. So we're seeing them between, you know, 600 and 800 million years after the Big Bang at this point. And that's just remarkable. So I want to show you some, you can't really see them, but these circles here represent some of these most distant objects that they've determined out of the ultra-deep field, giving us a redshift of 8. I mean, I don't know, you guys are not mostly observers, but when I was in a postdoc, somebody in my group discovered a galaxy at redshift of 4, and it was a phenomenal discovery. Everyone was just incredibly amazed. you know, that was, you know, billions of years after the Big Bang. Now we're up here into the hundreds of millions of years after the Big Bang, and we already see galaxies fully formed. Here's, yes.
I'd be getting uncomfortably close to 13.7.
Yes, we are now at 13, right?
So
we're seeing galaxies back to 13.
They have to have time to form.
They have to have time to form,
so
that's right.
So if you keep looking back and see something, I begin to get uncomfortable.
That's right. So if we see, at some point it's got to stop, right? Because galaxies have to have time to form. So that is, you know, Hubble has a limit now because its infrared camera only goes out so far in the infrared. And so the next major telescope that's coming down the pike post-Hubble is the James Webb Space Telescope, which is an infrared telescope. And the reason they designed it that way was to be able to push out all the way and see when galaxy formation began. Now, they can say something about these early galaxies, which as these highest redshifted objects appear to be smaller. You know, they're small. They're not as big as the more evolved galaxies. So merging, apparently, is a very important part of galaxy construction. And, of course, they don't have the heavy elements yet. When you start doing spectroscopy, you need some generations of stars to get the heavier elements in there. But we can already tell that the earliest galaxies are small and they don't have well-formed structure. So this feeds into the idea that merging played a large part in building up galaxies over time, and also inciting more star formation, because it appears that the growth of galaxies and the star formation rates peaked at a redshift of about 2, somewhere in there, and then since then, both the merging has slowed down and the star formation rate has slowed down as a whole. So we can already see that. Here's another image showing you what we call dropouts. They call them dropout galaxies. So you know, in this, the more reddened the filter where you can't see the galaxy, we call that a dropout. Here's a Y-band dropout. Here's a Z-band dropout that you can see in Y. The more redshifted the object is. So you hear a lot about dropout galaxies. Yes?
Is there a limit to how far back in time you can look? Do you run into a wall at some point, or?
Right. So what we're trying to do is, I mean, we've seen the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's sort of that, in a sense, is the limit in terms of before that light radiation has not been able to escape. So you can't see before that. What's missing is this gap between basically this and to the very earliest formation of galaxies. That's what the James Webb, I have another image that shows this sort of pictorial history of the universe. I don't think I put it in this package. The James Webb should be able to take us back all the way to basically the earliest formation of galaxies. And the other big question is, when was the universe re-ionized? Because you have these dark ages before stars formed, and then you have this period of time when stars first formed, and then the light from stars was able to start ionizing the gas around it, and that sort of created a sense of transparency. But when did that happen? There's arguments about whether that happened at a redshift of 6 or 7 or 8, and there had to be enough galaxies and stars to be able to generate this ionization that allowed the universe to become transparent. This data is helping us see that quite possibly that reionization could have happened earlier on because there were enough galaxies. But that is a really hot topic right now, is the era of reionization. I think this data is tantalizing because we didn't realize that galaxies were formed quite this soon until just now. And so now we have to understand, how is it that galaxies can form within, you know, hundreds of millions of years, not billions of years, hundreds of millions of years. They're not fully formed, they're not very big, but they're definitely galaxies. So that's a hot topic. Here's another view of this ultra-deep field showing you some of these oddly shaped high redshifted galaxies. They're not spirals. You don't see that beautiful spiral structure, right? It takes time for structure to form and for rotational processes and merging to create final products. All right. So that's the high redshift end of the universe. Hubble is also looking very locally. We're quite interested in a very different topic, which is extrasolar planets. I lead the lab for exoplanets and stellar astrophysics at NASA Goddard, and that's another very hot topic, is finding extrasolar planets and understanding how they form. Yes, yes.
When you see these very old galaxies, are you sure what the light source is? Are you looking at stars, or are you looking at, you know, what's generating the light within the galaxy?
It depends on, you know, what you're looking at, but it's starlight because it's redshifted starlight. So ionized gas that's been ionized by the stars around it. So even though you're looking in infrared,
it's starlight.
It's basically starlight, right? Now, of course, if you're looking at quasars, I mean, there's certainly very active galactic nuclei that you look at when you're looking at quasars, things like that. That's probably an accretion disk process that you're looking at. But these are just normal galaxies. They're not quasars. All right, planetary, this is sort of the last topic I want to talk about, is planetary system formation. A few years ago, a group looked at a star system that seemed to have a lot of junk around it, a disk of some sort, with Hubble, with the NICMOS infrared camera, which is not as good of a camera, in a sense, as the infrared channel on the new camera. I know that's confusing. This is the old infrared camera. And it has a coronagraph, which allows you to block out starlight. So this is a picture of that star system, but with the star blocked out by the coronagraph. So the star would be here, but it's blocked out. And this is noise from the coronagraph coming out here. But this ring is real. It's a dust ring around this system. And by looking very carefully at the distribution of this ring, it was noticed that the center of the ring is offset from the position of the star. And we also noticed that the ring was very, very sharp. Both of these are indicative of a potential planet in this system, because planets tend to carve out and shape sharper rings around in disks around stars. And planets can also offset the center of orbits of the ring to be offset from the star itself. So there were two lines of evidence that a planet must be or might be greatly influencing the system, even though we couldn't actually see the planet. But we even had a press conference at this. The leader of this group, Paul Callas, and his group came to NASA headquarters, where I was working at the time. We had a press conference saying there ought to be a planet in here. We don't know what else would shape rings like this. And you see ring shaping also in our own solar system. The moons around Jupiter and Saturn tend to shape the rings of those planetary systems. Well, by looking at this data over the next few years, that planet was actually detected, buried in the data. It's very hard to see this, but you can see buried in this ring very carefully, you can actually see the planet. Now, this looks crude, but it is the first picture of a planet that we've ever taken outside of our solar system. Now, hundreds of planets have been detected over the last 15 years, but they've been detected indirectly by looking at the radial velocity wobble of the parent star, or by looking at transits of the planet between the observer and the star, and you can see the starlight dipping periodically. But what we really want to do is to be able to take pictures of planets so that you can do spectroscopy on the planet so that you can find out if there are Earth-like planets. So this was a very exciting find. And in fact, the same week, another group announced yet the same thing, direct observations of a planetary system, in this case, three planets. This is Moreau et al. Using the Gemini Observatory from the ground. So isn't this exciting? These planets are not Earth-like. They're huge multi-Jupiter mass objects, all of these. But nevertheless, it's a proof of concept that you can, in fact, now start to take images of planets. And the race is on now to find a coronagraph technique that will work well enough to suppress starlight to 10 orders of magnitude so that you can see things as small and faint as an Earth around another star. Studying how they form is also a hot topic. We believe, theoretically, that stars form in interstellar clouds, and eventually, as they form and work through several stages of circumstellar disk material, that disk will be able to produce planets. The theory is that the gas giants form first, while the disks around the star still have gas. And then as the gas gets swept away from the new starlight turning on, you get leftover debris that can form into terrestrial planets before most of the rest of the debris is cleared out. And what you can actually observe, however, is the disk at these different stages, a disk that's gas-rich, a disk that has much less gas and much more dust, and then a disk that's dominated by dusty debris left over and maybe planets. We have a lot of people doing this in my lab. Hubble is good at finding some of these disks, usually in silhouettes, because the dust is blocking and obscuring starlight. So these are young star systems that have jets, bipolar jets, because they're still accreting, and they have dark dust lanes across their equatorial zone where they have an accretion disk around them. I showed you this already. I got that twice. Yes. Chronograph technique is very simple conceptually. It's that you are simply blocking out the star. You know, you have a this ground-based technique. They've done something different. They've done a rotational subtraction of. It's a fancy. I forget what they call it. It's not adaptive optics, but it's a technique where they'll take multiple images and be rotating. Rotating the telescope, rotating the field over and over again for this whole system. And apparently by doing this kind of rotation, they are able to better subtract the starlight out of the image itself while retaining the planets surrounding them. I don't know the details of this technique. This other technique, the space-based image, was done by actually putting, you know, physically a block in the telescope to block the star, the light of the light path to allow only the outer regions of the field of view to get through. Now the problem is when you want to do things as small as an Earth, light, just flat coronagraphs don't work very well because you can still get refractions of light and things around the coronagraph. So we're trying different things in our lab, things like interferometry where you can put a tiny little interferometer inside the telescope that will actually cause different light paths to cancel each other out and leave only things not directly along the pointing direction to allow through. And we're also developing the idea of something that sounds fanciful but might actually work, which is an external occulter where you put basically a star shade tens of thousands of kilometers in front of the telescope, and you basically use it to block the starlight before it ever even gets to the telescope. And then you can make a much more simple camera inside the telescope. You don't have to worry about the star blocking the starlight on the way. It's a hot topic right now, and there are four or five different groups in the U.S. and maybe some in Canada that are developing different coronagraph or ideas and techniques and approaches, and they're all being debated right now about what's the best one to use. I know I need to finish up here, but Hubble is not good at finding extrasolar planets. We need a bigger telescope that's designed to survey for actually imaging extrasolar planets. So these were unusual examples. Hubble is good for studying them once you find them, especially if they are transiting planets. You can do studies of the atmosphere of these planets as the starlight goes through the atmosphere. What are we doing to find exoplanets? Well, one thing is launching a different kind of telescope. And last year we launched something called Kepler, which is right now staring at a very distant cluster of bright stars and just watching them and counting the statistics of how many of them show periodic dimming due to transits. And by doing so, it can find the statistics on the number of stars that you can expect to have planetary systems and what kinds of planets, even down to Earth-sized planets. Now, because the field is so far away to get enough stars to do the statistics in the field, they're also too far away to do follow-up studies. So even if it finds an Earth-like planet, we won't be able to do a lot of follow-up spectroscopy. But at least we'll get the statistics for the first time from this telescope after a few years as to how many planets are normally seen around different types of stars. It's already found five. Now, this has only been up a few months, so obviously, to find an Earth-like planet around a Sun-like star, you need at least 1 year to get a full orbit, and of course several years to really confirm that you've got a transiting system. But you can find these systems where the planet is very close to the parent star, and Kepler has been doing that, finding these planets. This represents the dip in starlight with every transit, and these are these very hot, you know, strange, very fast orbiting systems that have an entire year in a matter of days. So they're very hot planets. They're Jupiter-type planets. They're not Earth-like at all, but it's the first step, and over the next few years, Kepler will be detecting smaller and smaller planets. We'll have a better idea of what's out there. These are the relative sizes of these new planets that Kepler has discovered relative to Jupiter and tiny little Earth over here, so you can get a sense of what the first planet detections are. And one thing that might be possible that we're finding is that our solar system may be unusual in having our gas giants way out in the outer realm and having our terrestrial planets in the inner part of the solar system. It may become the case that in other solar systems, it's more common to find large gas giants in the inner region of their system, in which case it may be very difficult to have terrestrial planets at all, or at least in the habitable zone, not too far or too close from their parent star. So that's something we'll find out with more Kepler data. Yeah.
The gas would take off if they were too close to the star. How is it?
There they are. I don't know. Although I do know that they think planets migrate, so it may be that they don't stay very long. I don't know whether they migrate. I've heard them. Sometimes they migrate in. Sometimes they migrate out. And it's not my expertise. So. It could be that they don't stay. Either these are going to be short-lived planets, and they've migrated in their atmosphere, and as you say, their outer atmosphere. Either they're going to migrate all the way and be destroyed, or their atmospheres are going to be swept away, and what you might be left with is whatever the core of these things are, which might become a terrestrial planet. Or they're going to migrate back out and remain in the outer solar system. I don't know. It's not my expertise. But this is a surprise, right? They didn't expect to find, over the past few years, all these gas giant planets so incredibly close to their parent star. So that's why we need theoretical physicists and astrophysicists to figure this out. How is this happening? This is the number of exoplanet discoveries over the past few years. And you can see it's just skyrocketing. This last year, 85. Most of these are discovered through these radial velocity detections of stellar wobble. But we also have a few detections through these transits and other more fancy techniques like the microlensing of a planetary system of a background source, even pulsar timing. And now we have two systems where we have direct imaging detections. And this is just a kind of a summary of the mass of things. I'm just showing you all this to remind you that exoplanets are a very hot topic right now, and Hubble will play a role in some of the follow-up studies, but we really do need a different kind of telescope to survey the heavens for Earth-like extrasolar planets. So these are the planets discovered so far. These are in masses of Jupiter. So an Earth mass, this would be where you would find an Earth mass planet is right here, and we have not found any sort of planet to that size yet, because we don't have the technology to do that just yet. Kepler may help us. What does Hubble do, though? It is especially good at looking at the spectroscopy of planetary atmosphere. So here's a representation of something Hubble did in 2008, was to look at one of these transiting planets and note the atmospheric composition, because on the outer realm of this planet, the starlight will go through the atmosphere. Hubble can study what's been absorbed and tell you something about what's in the atmosphere. So in this particular planet, methane was found. And in other exoplanets, things like sodium have been found, even evidence of water. So these are gas giant planets, but it is a very interesting type of science for its own right. All right, so Hubble is poised to do excellent science for the next 5 years at least, we hope. And then by that point, the James Webb Space Telescope should be launched to kind of carry us on into the next few years of astrophysics. So it's an exciting time. We're real happy about it. And this is my last slide. One of the last pictures they took after they finished the servicing mission was looking back at Earth. And what you can see here as the sun I guess is setting or rising, I'm not sure. But you can see this very, very thin atmosphere of the Earth, and it kind of reminds us how tenuous our atmosphere is and how fragile it is. It's beautiful and fragile, and we need to take care of it. And so that's it. I hope you've enjoyed this little Hubble tour. So.
We have just a few minutes for questions. Maybe first of all, there's sessions.
Yeah, so you mentioned that those gas calibers and star forming regions form when you get a few stars that form and then they blow away low density gas, mm-hmm. and you have all of high density gas remaining. So is the high density gas differentiated from the low density gas only by density, or are they like chemically different parts of the cloud?
Well, it's hard to say since the lower density stuff is gone, so you can't look at it. But I would say it's differentiated mainly by density because clouds are turbulent. So you basically get turbulent regions where you'll get these are transitory phases where you'll get overdense regions and underdense regions. So it's basically the same material. Now that can not be the case if you have a region that's been cleared out by, like, say, a supernova remnant where you actually have some sort of injection into the system, and that can create some sort of chemical gradient.
So this is not analogous to the situation in geology where you have, like, some hard rock that got injected up into soft rock and then the soft rock got blown away?
No, it's not. I don't think it's analogous to that at all. I think this is all about just transitory turbulent eddies where you suddenly get slightly overdense regions relative to slightly underdense regions. Yeah.
Okay. So is the new telescope or observatory going to be designed in the same way as Hubble that has parts that are replaceable as technology improves? And if so, how are we going to replace them given the space shuttle might be going?
Perceptive question. How do you service a telescope if you don't have a shuttle anymore? The James Webb Space Telescope is not being designed to be serviced. And so that's, and there are a few reasons for that. One, I think probably the overt reason is that it's being placed very far away. It's being put in one of these Lagrange point orbital stability points, in this case L2. It's very far away, and the reason for that is that it's a sensitive infrared telescope. You want it as far away from the Earth as you can get it. It's a much better place. Hubble isn't a terrible place for a telescope. I mean, it's in a great place if you're going to surface it, but otherwise, it's orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes. That means pretty much half the time, depending on where you're pointing it, you're occulted by the Earth. You know, so it's a very inefficient observatory. James Webb will be, you know, way the heck out there so that it doesn't have to worry about spending half its time, basically. You know, Hubble literally does waste half its time because it's hard to fill those slots when the Earth is in the way. So it will be far away for that reason. It's also, servicing the telescope has been both a joy and a pain in the neck for NASA because it requires a human spaceflight program to coordinate with the astrophysics part of NASA, which are like two different universes. So it's really been challenging. But it will not be serviceable, and so that is a risk if something goes wrong. Most of you probably don't remember, but when Hubble was launched in 1990, it had a very severe optical problem, basically a blurry vision, and so they had to go up and do a correction because the mirror was incorrectly ground. So they had to repair it. If they hadn't been able to service Hubble, we would not have had the last 20 years of I guess it's more like 17 years, we've had good images out of Hubble. So you take a risk with the James Webb Space Telescope, but because of its orbit, it's not serviceable.
Is that orbit inside the radiation belt?
Yeah, it's I'm trying to think where L2 is. I can't remember how far out, what far that is, but it is
like 3/4 of the way to the moon, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a significant. It's Earth's sun, L2, and it's a significant distance out, so it's above the radiation. So yes, it's vulnerable. Yeah.
This discontinuance of the space shuttle is a kind of political decision, obviously. I just wonder if you have anything that you can say about the politics of this business. Or is that something?
It's a wonderful decision, and I support it 100%.
Like that. I realize it's a tricky question.
It's being recorded.
I mean, and please be
on line for everyone who wants.
these things must come up. I mean, you must have.
Considered. Oh, of course. Yeah, no, this is a huge issue, and it's not over yet because you see, the way U.S. politics works is that in the beginning of February, the president announces this is what the budget will be, and it includes the closure of the space shuttle program and all that. But then Congress has the next few months to say, wait just a minute, and they fight over this. And so for the next few months now, we're going to have all sorts of discussions over whether this is really what's happening, because especially the people from Texas and Florida are very concerned about jobs. And so, you know, to close down the space shuttle program will mean devastating for those local economies, things like that. So there'll be a lot of discussion about this for sure. But the idea is that the space shuttle has been around for a long time now, and there's been, for the last few years, a lot of discussion about wanting to do something more exciting and that can get astronauts out of low Earth orbit. The only thing astronauts can do right now, because of the space shuttle's limitations, is to go to low Earth orbit. And the only thing you can do in low Earth orbit is either service satellites of some kind, or do work on the International Space Station. Well, the International Space Station is not real. Maybe I should turn this on. It's a wonderful platform for science. It's had mixed reviews from the scientists as to whether it's really a premier platform for doing any kind of science. And much of that problem is because until now there's only been two or three people up there at any one time, and it takes almost all their time just to maintain the station, so it hasn't been a great science platform. Now they're starting to put six or seven astronauts on the crew up there all the time, so you can actually do some other science. And what that other science is still kind of puzzling. But nevertheless, they're active now. But those are the only two choices. There's a lot of energy around the idea of kind of getting out of this mode and sending astronauts beyond. And so that was the idea behind trying to build a new rocket that's more powerful, that can get astronauts maybe back to the moon, build a more long-term base there, maybe go to an asteroid, maybe eventually go to Mars. You know, let's get our space exploration going again. But there wasn't enough money injected into... Oh, the only way you can afford to do that is if you close down the space shuttle program so that you can funnel the space shuttle money into the development of this new architecture. So there wasn't quite enough money over the last couple of years actually funneled into this to actually make this return to the moon business realistic in the near-term future. So it's all kind of a mess right now, but the idea is to close down the shuttle program and build a new launch vehicle. It just may take more years to do that, which means that the U.S. is going to be dependent on the Russians to get back and forth from the space station using their Soyuz spacecraft for the next, decade, basically. So, I do think the space shuttle has kind of done its thing, and maybe it would be exciting to build a new launch vehicle, but it does look like there's going to be a few lean years here where we have no launch vehicle at all. And it's not a high priority for the U.S. right now. The U.S. has a great budget deficit, and building a new launch vehicle to launch people into outer space is not the highest priority for the American taxpayer at large right now.
Does anyone else have anything that can get people out of low Earth orbit?
I think China is launching astronauts to the moon. They've not landed on the moon yet, but that's their stated plan. And India, I think, has some ambitions in this respect. So those are the two that I know of. Yes?
Is there any reason you couldn't build a space telescope literally right next door to the space station? Is there a reason it has to be separated?
Yes. The space station is... a poor platform for a telescope. If you attach it, there's all kinds of vibrations. That's a terrible thing. even if it's in the nearby vicinity, apparently the station is just a ball of contaminants orbiting around. I mean, it just carries this cloud of contaminants around it, of some kind. I mean, enough that it would create a poor environment for a telescope is what I have understood. And so, you know, there might be the situation where you could do something at the station to assemble the telescope and then give it some sort of a gentle launch off of there so that you get it away. So I think that's probably being looked at. Many times, though, what we've been asked over the last couple of years is to tell us, you know, what kind of telescopes would be good to put on the moon. If astronauts go back to the moon, couldn't they tend and put telescopes on the moon? And that discussion generally ends with astronomers being very unenthusiastic. And the reason is that the moon is really not a very good platform for most telescopes. When you think about it, our telescopes are doing just fine without having to be on a solid surface. The Hubble Space Telescope is in orbit. You know, all of our space telescopes now are in orbit or in some either Earth-centered orbit or sun-centered orbit. Earth-trailing orbits are popular as well. So we don't need to set the telescope on a solid surface. And in fact, having a gravitational pull can distort the shape of a telescope. And the moon is dusty to boot. So it's just, there's not much to say for it unless astronauts were going there anyway, you know, for some other reason. And you could get a cheap ride for a telescope up with the astronauts and they could tend it, you know, that economically it might make some sense. But scientifically it doesn't make a lot of sense, except for low frequency radio astronomy, in which case having the moon as a kind of a shield from Earth interference is a nice idea. So you could put these low frequency antennas on the far side of the moon and have a natural shield. That's really the only thing that makes a whole lot of sense. Yeah.
Is there any way that they would consider launching telescopes from the moon? Like, would that help in any way?
Launching telescopes from the moon. Well, this isn't as fanciful as it sounds, because there's been discussion that maybe the moon, with its lower gravitational pull than the Earth, would be a better place to try to pour and construct a mirror. You can, you know, imagine spinning material and get a telescope mirror very precisely round is a difficult endeavor. So there have been some thoughts that the moon's surface might be a better place to try to build a telescope mirror. But when you start thinking about how complicated this would actually be to do this, and then what would you do with it once you built it? You know, again, you're still on the moon, so you know, it's just not very realistic. So, yeah.
Maybe one last question here.
Yeah.
So I was curious if you could maybe give us a preview of what you think we might be finding out about extrasolar planets, particularly terrestrial planets, with the new Hubble instrumentation, the James Webb, whatever else you've got.
Okay. So with Hubble, it's a little limited to what it can do. I think the most interesting thing it can do is more work on these transiting systems and doing atmospheric chemical analysis of Jupiter-sized gas giant planets that happen to be transiting so that you can do this kind of absorption spectroscopy. James Webb will also do that kind of spectroscopy, but it can do it in the infrared, which gives you a broader, more interesting spectrum. There are water lines and things that are in the infrared that we would love to see if it's in the atmosphere. But still, the James Webb is probably most attuned to the larger planets, the Jupiter-like planets. If you really want to survey the sky for Earth-sized planets and do spectroscopy, you need a different kind of telescope that's designed for that. You need a Hubble-like optical type setup, except you need it bigger than Hubble. Hubble is a 2.5-meter aperture telescope. You need something on the order of 4 or even 8 or 16 meters to really have the sensitivity that you need to do a real comprehensive search and survey for these kinds of things. So I think what you're going to see with Hubble and JWST is detailed analyses, for the most part, of large planets and maybe what we call super Earths, which are things that are, you know, 5 to 10 times the size of the Earth, which may be considered terrestrial, but
quite different from Earth in many respects, but still very interesting to study. And then surveying for Earth is going to require something different. Some have proposed an interferometer, an optical interferometer in space called, one concept is called the Space Interferometry Mission, SIM, and it would look for astrometric wobbles of stars. And by doing astrometric wobbles, you can actually get more precision than you can do with radial velocity detection. The astrometric signal actually gives you enough information because you've got two dimensions in the sky to determine the mass of the object, whereas these radial velocity determinations give you the mass with an uncertainty of the sign of the inclination. You don't know what the inclination is. So anyway, you can get you can do a precise survey of finding Earth-like planets precisely by their positions and mass using a space interferometer, but you can't do the spectroscopy with that. You still need a telescope that's big enough and have a good enough coronagraph. I talked about these different concepts of coronagraphs that are being developed, or an external occulter to block out the starlight to 10 orders of magnitude so that you can actually isolate the planet and do spectroscopy on it. And of course, what you want is a planet in the what's called the habitable zone, which is a place that's not too close to its parent star, not too far away, so that you can have the potential for liquid water. Now, what's interesting is that people are now looking, first and foremost, at the idea of looking for planets around stars that are not sun-like, but that are smaller than the sun and less bright, these M-dwarfs we call. If you have an M-dwarf star, the star is not so bright, so you don't need to have quite so much light suppression technology. It's not real good for taking images, but it's great for transits, because if you think about it, the habitable zone of a smaller star is closer in, so you can get an Earth-like planet in its habitable zone around a smaller star that has a much faster year, so you can find these transits faster and do the transit spectroscopy quicker. So those are things that can be done sooner than the chance we'll have to build an 8 to 16 meter telescope. So there's a lot of ideas out there, but I don't think Hubble and James Webb, either one, will be our big finding scope for these things, but they will be able to do some very detailed transit spectroscopy on the ones that we find some other ways.
Okay, before we finish, let me just mention that we're taking a speaker to a early dinner, it's 5 o'clock in the bistro. If you'd like to join us, please either tell me or just come along at 5 o'clock. So let's thank Jennifer for a wonderful talk.
I wanted somebody to ask me an annoying question.